Good evening. My particular perspective on pandemics comes from more of the business side. I study in the business school at Cambridge University, and most of the sponsors of research that we work with are major corporates. They are life insurers. They are primary insurers and global corporates. And most of the stuff that we work on are threats to the global economy. And I think my sort of particular take on this is that pandemics, the argument for better preparedness for pandemics is actually an economic one as much as it is a healthcare and a kind of humanitarian one. So I want to sort of come at it from that particular perspective. I'm going to echo some of the points that our previous speakers have made. And what I'd like to talk about just are some scenarios that we've looked at for present-day pandemics. They are somewhere slightly less virulent than the worst-case scenario we've seen presented for the National Risk Assessment. But what we're focusing on here is what is their overall impact in society and economics that we think makes a pretty reasonable case for a broader scale of intervention and preparedness. So I'd like to talk quickly about what sorts of pandemics would look like specifically for the economy, but I'm going to touch on kind of healthcare capacity and some of the key pieces from a sort of objective set of scientists who are working at the side trying to help businesses with their preparedness problems. I'd like to talk on trends that we think are increasing pandemic risk. Each year we publish a risk register of threats to the global economy, and we monitor where pandemic sits relative to terrorism and financial crises and other, cyber risk and various other components that are. And we try to essentially quantify how much risk there is one to another, which is quite a hard task, as you can tell. But when you sort of translate how much impact are they having on the global economy, it helps us get our arms around that. So we look at certain trends, and I want to pick on two sets of trends. One, what are the trends that are increasing pandemic risk? What are the trends that are reducing pandemic risk? How who's winning? And then this issue of the recurrence of the 1918 pandemic, of course, it's really great that we're using the anniversary to raise awareness of this, but of course, as you've already heard, the 1918 pandemic will never occur again. What else might be out there? And what is the range of things we need to sort of worry about? And is there such thing as a worst case scenario? So I want to just a quick report on that. And then the sorts of things that we've been advising our kind of research sponsors in a way is how could we be better prepared from the partnership between the private sector and government and policymakers. So I think it is something that we do need to consider in that kind of overall framework. So we published a study a year or two ago on a hypothetical pandemic scenario, again, really to try and understand the business impact, the economic activities. Kind of give away the headline straight away. It's between $7 trillion and $23 trillion to the global economy from the kind of level of a relatively moderate virulence outbreak of an influenza virus. We looked at something that was at the higher end of the infection level, because what we were interested in is this disruption to the business activities in the global economy. Catherine Hammond showed the kind of levels of absenteeism we might expect in businesses, which is, she showed a number of 17 to 25%, which is pretty close to the sorts of levels we think look at for perhaps 2 or 3 weeks. Just remember, a business can tolerate up to about 7, 8, 9% of absenteeism in their business. Some people quote the 10% number of being people you can do without, and I always wonder why they hired them in the first place. But 10% seems to be about something that a business can kind of cope with. Once we get into the 17, 25%, the business is effectively closed down. So the issue is actually there is a massive economic disruption shock that kind of flows around the world. So you know, there's various points where do you start the scenario and so on. So what insurance companies do is they simulate large numbers of these. So there are thousands of events that get used in these. I'm just going to give you one particular example that shows the issue of vaccine and stuff. So you'll have seen illustrations like this before where the pandemic begins and I think I had an animation that I've lost. It doesn't matter. We talked about it. The actual time it takes to go around the world could be large numbers of months. In this case, it's about 9 months travel from one country right to another. But at each time, you have a particular blitz, a very rapid spread around the world, spread by air traffic. And the air traffic, as we've already shown, Heathrow is one of the central hubs, and we get a lot of wherever you start it, there's a lot of through traffic. I was going to say flu traffic, but that's also true. That flows through the country, and it works its way right around the entire world. That's the key issue, and so the world will face about 9 months of this disruption. And you can imagine if you're a global business trying to manage the fact that you've now got absenteeism going on in your Chinese operations at the same time as you're trying to manage stuff perhaps a few months earlier or perhaps a few months later in your United States market. This becomes an extremely disruptive and quite complicated method to manage. And businesses themselves are investing large sums of money and thought processes in their own risk management for these kinds of events and trying to explore how bad, how impactful, and what could they do to partner with government to help with this particular problem. So these are the kinds of estimates that our analysis tends to produce, consultations that are kind of within almost doubling the amount of consultations that we currently cope with in the system. Hospitalization demand, as in people who would normally have been treated if there were hospital capacity, in the United Kingdom, that's about 16x of our current capacity in terms of spare beds that are just normally available. So we run our healthcare system at about 86% efficiency, you know, and that's driven obviously by needs to run efficient healthcare systems. The United States, they run it slightly more redundant. They have about 68% of occupancy of their beds, but they end up with about a 6x of spare capacity. So this kind of hospital surge capacity is pretty critical. There are a lot of plannings in healthcare systems, and particularly the private healthcare providers in the United States that have whole layered contingencies of temporary hospital centres that get set up, as we do in the United Kingdom, of course. But obviously, as we've already mentioned, the intensive care is just almost impossible. The demand for that is two orders of magnitude larger than spare capacity and so on. So these have serious implications in the knock-on effect. The other sort of oddity, just from an academic looking at this, the whole thing around the world, is this is a global problem. But the pandemic strategies that you have, there are now 160 countries that have filed their pandemic preparedness plan with the World Health Organization, and there are basically two classes. There's the gold class, which is pharmaceutical response, and then there's the poorer countries, the lower GDP per capita, who actually have to rely on non-pharmaceutical strategies. So this feels like a great divide, and it's one common problem. We share the same problem, that we're all trying to reduce the spread of infected people around the world, and I would argue that as we try to model, they've got this country that's now sort of stockpiled Tamiflu, so it's treating its population, but it's still got plenty more people coming in from these other infected countries that have not managed to have quite the same amount of a kind of healthcare attention. So that is just an observation from the outside, that this is a global problem, and we tend to still regarding it perhaps as national, as a national problem or something, and clearly we're tempted to do that. But my big takeaway is just the overall scale of the pandemic. It's likely to take stock markets down. It will devalue all investment, pensions, portfolios, savings. These are projected changes in the credit ratings of individual sovereign countries. We're looking at an extremely high, a very impactful financial crisis. So it's not just healthcare. This is a financial crisis that affects the world. If you thought Brexit was bad, this is coming even more severely. Sorry, I shouldn't have mentioned it. But of course, what we've talked about is an assumption that the vaccine arrives, the cavalry arrives 6 months after the pandemic starts, and we cut out the second wave, and there is, we return to normal. But as you test that scenario with what happens if the response systems that we've worked out on paper fail to survive contact with the enemy, as I think the expression you used. What if the preparedness and response plans don't quite do as they're expected, and that fails? Well, that adds about 15% to the death toll. What happens if the vaccine is delayed? What happens if it gets complicated and it's too virulent even for the egg manufacturing or those sorts of things? We get some problems with the vaccine that can add some similar amount. And what if all those things happen together? Well, you're then looking at the whole death toll going up by a third. So these are quite severe kind of issues. And the kind of bottom line, just to show you, is that the private healthcare systems in the United States and others bear about $120 billion of investment or loss in these kinds of outcomes. So I just want to come back to, so what are the things that might be making this worse? Let's start first from that point of view. What are the trends that are increasing pandemic risk? Well, top of my list is gain of function research. So people who are actively trying to make make viruses more virulent. We need scientific research to thoroughly understand all of these pieces, but I'm one that believes that our gain-of-function research is under-policed, but I'm happy to talk more about that later on. I think there is increasing prevalence of antimicrobial resistance that many of our conventional bacteria strains that we're talking about, secondary infections, we're very concerned about those issues. There are growing populations of livestock where in emerging economies which are becoming the zoonotic reservoirs for future new strains that are making those. We see, if you just look at the World Health Organization statistics, we've seen improving efficiency of healthcare, which means reducing surge capacity. So we do see that as an overall trend. Pharmaceutical companies are less motivated to carry out vaccine research. Their business models don't really support these kinds of vaccine development activities. And obviously, as has already been mentioned, the sort of increasing levels of international travel, larger volumes coming generation after generation. We tried to quantify the effect of antimicrobial resistance on a future pandemic scenario. We just sort of switched off. This is, as I said, we're about one-tenth of the death toll in the United Kingdom. We if you assume certain levels of failure of our standard antibiotics, you get significant increases in the death toll that would occur. So we think that's something really to sort of care about. What are the trends that are decreasing pandemic risk overall? So we've already mentioned the fact that there is, our technology for vaccines is pretty manual, old-fashioned, and relies on large numbers of eggs to actually create. And if we switch to a cell culture manufacturing technique, you can increase the volume, you can speed things up very significantly. We talked about the possibility of universal influenza vaccines. That would be extremely helpful for influenza. And as I said, just the increasing healthcare expenditure and capacity, we are doubling in wealth the global economy is doubling in wealth about every 22 years. So we actually have more resources to combat these issues overall, taking very big picture. Overall. But I think there are also some really major concerns in the emerging infectious disease space. So things like We're getting, you know, we've just finalised a really good vaccine for Ebola, and there are other vaccines on the way for some of the worst hemorrhagic fevers, because once we start talking about worst case scenarios, those really do end up on the top end of our fear spectrum. There's some great work going on in disease surveillance in emerging economies, much better networks of detection and reporting and monitoring of clusters of outbreaks that are going on, and some very interesting better coordination of international rapid response initiatives, World Health Organization disease bonds, where they trigger money to go and suppress an outbreak through a securitized financial bond. So just coming up to sort of finish off, how this whole issue of what do we like to see? Well, 1918 was certainly one, you know, the worst pandemic that we can really measure and understand. There are some other hints in the literature that maybe there were some other bad pandemics in notable history. We just don't have the medical science records and the understanding from those times. The deaths from 1918 would be largely treatable from the secondary bacterial infections would be treatable with antibiotics today, and so, you know, there is a danger that we might end up sort of being like generals fighting the previous war and not being ready for the next thing that nature might try to throw at us. Exactly. So what might nature throw at us next? So this is a mapping. You've seen similar diagrams in this already. So contagiousness, sort of how infectious the virus or the pathogen is on the bottom axis, and then how virulent or deadly is the virus on the north axis. These are all probably impossible to read, probably. But there are various different types of pathogens that have different spreads and virulence capabilities. What we're talking about at the moment is this is one which is quite down here, actually, compared to many of the things that nature has managed to throw at us in the past. And so we actually need to worry about this entire space. Can nature create new types of pathogens that can combine in these various ways? It's proved pretty ingenious in the past of finding new ways of finding those. So we actually need to be prepared for any of these on the board. And of course, historically, we've seen some very, very bad ones of plagues, where we've lost a third of our population with very high mortality rates, which, again, we're not going to go into the argument of could those ever occur again, but hemorrhagic viruses that had high infectious rates would be a real nightmare scenario for us all to deal with. So what are the chances? Well, historically, we've had about a global pandemic, something that crosses international boundaries, that is a new emerging, and something we don't have the toolkit to deal with, about once every 13 years. So every year you get dealt a card. If it's an ace, we have a pandemic. Roughly, we think, I advise the response, about two-thirds of those probably influenza. Influenza itself is one of the most adaptive and changing strains. It's proven extremely creative in its evolution. And they obviously have these major burdens, and the whole series of threats on the pathogens with pandemic potential, the three Ps. So all of those we think are potential things that we ought to be looking for. And again, the way the insurance industry, the way that finance thinks about this, is not is there a single scenario that we should prepare for, but what is the frequency and severity distribution of all possible things that we ought to worry about? And obviously, we worry about the more likely things. We worry about them more, but ultimately there is almost no answer to how bad could it ever be, because it's just a question of diminishing likelihoods. So The little analysis I was just showing you is what is about something around the 1 in 100, so 1% chance of it occurring next year, and that's what we think people would have to deal with. So pretty sizable risk to the global economy, as you'll see, with a kind of 1% odds of occurring. So my last slide, how could the UK, in brackets, the world, actually, because we don't think this is specific. Obviously, we're talking in a UK environment here today, and that's the subject of the debate. But it seems to me this isn't a UK problem. It's actually a global problem. It's a global threat. As we've just heard, you can't close the borders to this. This one will happen too fast. The Australian Pandemic Preparedness Plan does have a contingency to close its borders. Any analysis shows that that's too late, that's not actually going to be a very effective component of preparedness. I would suggest that the range of options means it's actually better just to take it on the chin, invest more in surge capacity for healthcare provision, which we think is quite key, than stockpiling drugs that are specific for one, even influenza, a particular threat. So identifying your threats probably is not as helpful as being able to respond to the weird and wacky stuff that nature might throw at us. I would argue that the vaccine development, the whole thing, much of our strategy is very dependent on vaccines, which we've outsourced to the private sector through a rather poor sort of business model for rewarding them, and that actually needs to change fairly radically. I don't think we should be preparing for a single reasonable worst-case scenario or what might realistically happen or what are the thesis, but we need to actually have a game plan for almost anything that could be thrown at us, with perhaps placing more emphasis on the more likely stuff, but just having some game plan for the very severe events, which is the way business kind of thinks. Finally, I would also sort of re-urge, we've already heard earlier this year and last about AMR being a really major concern, and I'd say it's a pandemic concern as well as a public health issue. Thank you.